White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 336.
A hidden keep, a leap not taken. Retrace your steps, escape your past. And the key will be yours at last. What part of your past are you trying to escape, Halliday?
Seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we are once again joined by my semi-regular co-host on this show and my regular co-host on the AU Wishbone and occasional co-host on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard, John.
Thank you, man. Excited to be here.
Well, this is a podcast we have waited anxiously to do for a very long time because we have both been fans of the Ready Player One novel for many years, since it came out probably in 2011, and we've known this movie was coming for several years now, and it got delayed from December all the way to the end of March because they were afraid they didn't want to compete with Star Wars Episode 8. And so finally on on the 28th was Wednesday, and it was in preview, but I had to work that night. So Thursday night, several of us, not Mira, she wasn't here and didn't get to go, but the rest of us went and saw it on Thursday night, and I have waited patiently. I've forgotten the entire movie now, of course, but I've waited patiently. It is now Sunday evening, and you have gotten to go see it. And so you probably know how I felt about it, though we'll get into more specifics on that. And now I get to find out what you thought about it. But first, let's set the rules up front. You want to do like we did with the book and with some other things and do like a no spoiler segment and then give a spoiler warning and do spoiler segment?
No. I think we got to go straight. I mean, you're not going to listen to this if you haven't. I think you should not listen to this podcast if you haven't seen the movie or read the book.
Okay.
But you think that's fair? I mean, I think it's going to be, I mean, we could do a few minutes of kind of just movie reviewish kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it's very quickly going to get into differences between the book and the movie and stuff. So my advice is, first of all, if you haven't read the book and you're listening to this podcast, you stop right now and go read the book.
Go read the book.
And then go see the movie, and then listen to this, and then you will have some perspective.
I think you're right, though. Let's do like a brief segment up front for anybody that just wants to know our overall impression, and then we can kind of dig down deep. One other thing I also want to address at some point during this show is the controversy, because the book was extremely popular and won several awards when it first came out in 2011, but In the last couple of years, people have really lined up to get to be the next person to throw poop at it. And so I've run into that a bit, both on Twitter and on Facebook, with friends of mine who are otherwise wonderful, delightful people. But by God, they intend that I should not enjoy that book and I should not like or see this movie. And it's absolutely startled me and appalled me somewhat. So we can touch on that a little bit too. But the first thing everybody's dying to know, because I tweeted out and I kind of let it be known pretty quickly that I really liked the movie. Now, I have to say, I've only seen it once. I'm going back to see it again on Monday with Mira. and I think she's really going to love it. But I am infamous for liking movies like this more when they first come out, and then over time, my enthusiasm wanes as reality sets in, okay? So, you know, when it's all shiny and new, I'm all about the good parts. But once it's kind of worn out, you know, been around a little while, I can start to see the flaws better. And I'll be the first person to admit that. So right now I'm saying I loved it. I give it an A. Very excited about it with, you know, again, you like you say, we're going to get into some comparisons and we'll see why some things are better or worse. But for right now, ladies and gentlemen, here is the overall how John thought about it. Go.
It was okay.
Wow.
Let me say this. Like you, I am ecstatic that this movie got made. I love the book. And so the idea that they were going to make this book that I love so much into a movie was thrilling. And I loved it. And I've been looking, just like you, I've been looking for this movie since the day it was announced. I was shocked they even decided to make a movie because I think the degree of difficulty was so high. And there was a lot of stuff in it that I really enjoyed, that I thought was great, but there were also some other parts that, some of them there were changes from the book and some of them were just movie things that I didn't love, but I mean, overall it was fine. It was an entertaining movie. I was entertained. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I didn't love it as much as the book though. I'm still delighted that they made it, and I'm delighted that I went and saw it. But part of it is I love the book so much that my expectations were really high.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Without spoilers still for another minute, they didn't so much like change things as just completely replaced things. And the things they replace, the new things were very different from the things they replaced. And so I'm still coming to grips with all the new things because they were so completely different from the old things that I liked so much. The comparison I would make, because we just went last night to the Wiley Theater in Edwardsville and saw Fellowship of the Ring on the big screen. It was the 10th time I've seen it in the theater, which is crazy. And first time Mira got to see it in the theater, and she loved it, even though it was 3 hours long. This was the theatrical cut. I would describe it, if you were going to compare the way they made the Ready Player One movie compared to the book, to the way that the Lord of the Rings movie compared to the book, it would be like if you still had the hobbits, you still had Gandalf, Aragorn, Boromir, you had the whole fellowship, you had all that. But when they set out from Rivendell, they have to pedal bicycles up a hill, up a bunch of hills, and then instead of going through Moria, they have to swing on vines, and instead of having to figure out the riddle to open the door, you know, to get into the cave, to get into the mines, instead they have to like run a foot race with orcs, and the winners get to get into the mines. And it's, I mean, I'm just, this is just like metaphorical, you know what I mean? But you see what I mean? It's like they just replaced whole sections of the story, even though the framework, it's like at the end, they, you know, at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, you still have Boromir getting killed and Frodo going off by it with Sam. So let's say that still happens at the end of the movie, but instead of a battle on Amon Hin, instead they, you know, Saruman shows up and they play a chess game or something, or have laser tag. You know what I mean? It was just a completely different set of events that get you to basically the same place. Is that fair?
That's fair. And I would tell you that the substitution of those things is not what I didn't like about the movie.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Let's put a bookmark there. I like that. That's good to talk about. Let's cover that. So anything else non-spoilery you want to touch on before we dig in?
I mean, I think if you are a book person or a person who's heard about this and you're concerned that it's going to be an entirely movie of 1980s pop culture stuff and you're not going to be able to relate to it, I would say not as much. I mean, it's that is not so much of a problem, I would say. There's some of that, but it's not. I didn't think that was beating you over the head.
No, I'm going to address that too, because that's part of the. There's several things that people throw at me when they're trying to poop on this movie and the book, and especially the book, and criticize it. And one of them is it's just a bunch of references. There's no actual story or characters. It's just a list of references. And I think that's completely ridiculous. You and I have talked about how much we love the book, and we've done whole shows on how much on the book, and we've analyzed and broken down the plot and the story. That's utter hogwash. I would say that for the case of both the book and the movie, the references are a nice sprinkling of sprinkles on top of the cupcake. But if it was just plain vanilla icing, in other words, if instead of the, you know, like you see this in the trailer, instead of it being like the Halo guys or the Iron Giant, instead if it was just like random future soldiers and big robot guy, it wouldn't affect the story 1%, would it?
No, not the pure part of the story. No. I mean, I think it, the thing those things do is make you as a human connect to the story. There's the core human kind of hero's arc part of the story. But these, all the pop culture references are like little threads that tie you in as a reader or a viewer to the larger story. And I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of a universe where all of those things are together in the same place, you know? Mm-hmm.
It's something to enjoy, but it's not something I don't understand how people say that that's all there is. It's a dystopian future story where, you know, people have been addicted to the internet and have therefore allowed regular society to kind of crumble. And you know, it's kind of a cautionary tale of don't go too far down that rabbit hole. It's funny because it's at the same time it both celebrates all this stuff and tells you watch out that you don't make it all that you care about, you know.
That's right.
There's a lot to it. And to say that it's just saying, you know, oh, I recognize that. Oh, I recognize that. Oh, I recognize that. I mean, yeah, like you say, I mean, it's part of it, but it's, you don't have to have it. Without it, you still have the same story to me. I mean, you still have this kid trying to win a contest to keep a big evil corporation from taking over, you know, the internet that everybody uses.
Yes.
And so how knowing those guys are Halo soldiers or not affects that is, to me, beyond my, I can't even comprehend.
But also, like, how the, and this is the other part that's really relevant that people don't get, is like the, how your virtual life and your real life are not the same, and they mm-hmm. become blurred and back and forth in the book and the movie both, and how events in one affect the other and your reputation in one affects the other and that kind of thing, which is really true.
I would say if there's one thing the movie, and again, this is not spoilers yet, we still haven't switched over, though, if there's one thing the movie gives short shrift on, it's, well, there's a couple of things, but one of them is it doesn't spend as much time. It's like it was edited down to be fast, and in the process, it lost some of the moments where they might have said, like, spent a little more time laying out the world as it is outside the Oasis and why all this matters so much.
Well, and even the world within the Oasis, other than the pieces they showed. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't want to get in the spoiler
right,
side, but that's
right. Yeah, you only see a tiny bit of it compared to the book. In the book, you see just, you know, like a galaxy, basically. In the movie, you see like, you know, three or four planets, it seems like.
Well, and you see like 30 seconds of three or four planets sometimes. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not.
Right.
So, anyhow.
All right. So, you want to, shall we migrate over to the spoiler section now?
Yes. Do not pass here. There be spoilers.
First, I got to play the trailer because this is the last one, the short one, but I think the most effective one. So, hit it!
A hidden keep, a leap not taken.
Retrace your steps, escape your past. And the key will be yours at last. What part of your past are you trying to escape, Halliday?
This is the Oasis. A whole virtual universe. You can do anything. Be anyone. Without going anywhere at all. The Oasis was created by James Halliday, and what he left behind changed everything. A contest. Three impossible challenges. The first to finish gets complete control of the Oasis, which means complete control of the future.
The contest has got to be about connecting with someone, connecting with the world. So we take it together?
Sure. Save the Oasis.
Save the world.
Players, are you ready?
That's better. I'll wave to you from the finish line. McFly.
That went well.
All right, I like that one a lot because I thought Aha was very effective in it as the music. You remember the first trailer? I don't think I'm going to play all the trailers. I'm just going to play that one, the last one. But the first trailer was one that had Tom Sawyer in it, and I didn't think it was as effective because it was funny because it focused mostly on the virtual reality stuff, but didn't show you very much of the virtual reality stuff. So it was kind of boring. But this last trailer is the one that had Aha in it, Take on Me. And it showed the race, a big chunk of the race. Unfortunately, I think it showed too much of the race because when we actually got to the movie, I'd seen most of the race, which was one of the cool, new, brand new things. So, but anyway, so let's dig into it a little bit. I know that one of the things we're both dying to do is talk about what's in it and what's taken out and whether that's good or bad. Now, one of the things that's missing from it entirely, I want to say up front, just structurally, are the gates. The gates just automatically appear when you find the key. What do you think about that?
Yes, like they had just the clues, like in this one. So in the and there was just one gate basically. In the books, there's a you get a key, there's a gate you go through, and you have to do something in the gate, and then there's a clue at the end of that.
And you have to find the gates totally separate from finding the keys. It's like six separate puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
Like you find that you go through the whole puzzle to find the key. And when you get the key, it gives you a clue to find the gate. And then you go through the whole puzzle to find the gate, which gives you a clue to go find the second key, and then on and on. So it's like six separate puzzles. Here, there were just three keys. And when you find the key, it gives you like a little scroll. Which is
I was okay with that because they didn't have time to do six.
Right. It sped it up.
Clue kind of things.
So. Yeah. Was it just me, though, or... Were the three puzzles for the three keys? I mean, it's not just that they were different, but they weren't like brain teasers. They were a lot of it was like a physical challenge, like driving the cars. That was the first thing that nobody had done. See, in the book, the reason nobody's on the scoreboard for 5 years is nobody could figure out what the Tomb of Horrors is or where it is. And Wade happens to figure that out right after Artemis figures it out. She actually figures it out first. She just can't win Joust. In the movie, it's that they all know the first thing to do. Everybody knows the first thing to do. It's that race. They just can't win it.
Which is interesting. And one of the big differences with the race versus the Tomb of Horrors thing, And I saw it with Ethan today, my son Ethan today, and one of his big things, because he loves the book too, uh-huh. is he loved the idea that the quest, the entire thing started on the school planet.
Yeah.
That it was designed to be available, so it was on the public school planet.
Yes.
And any child could be the first person to find it.
Absolutely. Yes. Halliday put thought into that and says, I want the first key to be in a place where anybody can get to it. And I think he probably knew that even if some poor punk kid was the one to find it, he'd make enough money from that, like Wade does, to be able to continue on the rest of the way. You know, he's gonna. That's the thing in the book, is that Wade makes so much money endorsing products after he's the first person to find the copper key that he can continue. And that's, I thought that was really clever.
It was, and it's another thing that they kind of touch on in the movie, like with him collecting the gas money during mm-hmm. the race and stuff, mm-hmm. but that you still don't get the full comprehension of, in the real world and in the virtual world, he is poor and relatively powerless in the right. virtual world at the beginning of the book. And so the idea that he's competing against this billion-dollar corporation to win this contest is, you know, make it much more dramatic.
Right. Yeah, I just finished listening to the Will Wheaton audio performance for like the fourth time, and I enjoyed it every bit as much, if not more, this time. And by the way, let me just recommend, if you've read the book, if you've watched the movie, and you still want another experience of it that's different, please do yourself a favor and get the Audible audiobook of Ready Player One. I actually got it on Apple Audio several years ago for $5. It's on regular Audible now for like whatever it costs for one thing on Audible, like $15 or whatever. But it is so good. Will Wheaton, he performs it, and he puts so much drama into every line that even like the infamous, like chapter 3 that just like that has the info dump,
Yes.
The way that Will Wheaton performs that chapter is like listening, you're listening to Uber Geek explain this sci-fi world, and it's fascinating. Reading it is very dry, but when you listen to Will Wheaton talking about it, it's awesome. So, I mean, if you find the book slow going at the beginning, just get the audiobook. It's awesome. Okay. When I was listening to it this time, I was really thinking more about how Wade was like a level 3 character inside mm-hmm. the Oasis, and he was doing good to be level 3. He was hitching rides from H, who was a little higher up, to go to planets where he just killed orcs or something all day.
And kobolds.
Yeah, and collected their copper coins and stuff. So, yeah, they kind of compress all that into people turning into coins. And I did like that. I thought that was an interesting touch that they added to the movie, was how people turn into coins so that you could collect the money. That's kind of out of like Mario Brothers or something, isn't it?
And it's very video game-ish. Like the PvP video game or regular video game. You kill something and you collect their loot. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was neat. So the race. Clearly Spielberg and I guess the screenwriter Zach Penn and Klein himself. By the way, Klein co-wrote the screenplay, and I was fascinated to think that he's willing to change it this much. I mean, did he just think this would work better, or you suppose he thought that there were some mistakes he made in the novel that he had a chance to go back and do differently?
No, I mean, I think this is, we referenced this earlier. I think the change in the challenges mm-hmm. from what they were in the book to the movie made the movie better. Like, as a young person, I played Dungeons & Dragons, and I loved it. And I had the Tomb of Horrors module, and I knew exactly what it was when he started talking about it. And so the idea that that was the first, clue, and that was where he had to go to get the first key and then to beat the Lich and Joust was really exciting to me.
Right.
But that's not a reference that a lot of people are going to get. And I think it would have been pretty dry to have him by himself crawling through a dusty tomb, and because he already it has the module from the 1980s. You know, he dodges all the traps and everything,
right?
And gets to the end and then just plays Joust. And I think in one thing I knew they weren't going to do was show him playing hours worth of video games.
Right.
I mean, playing Joust or playing Pac-Man wasn't going to be part of the thing. And the same with the second challenge,
yeah,
where they use the idea from the book of the immerse yourself in the movie thing. But they didn't go to – but they – in this, because the second challenge of the book, one of them, they go to the Zork planet.
Right.
And that's something that, like, nobody cares about and visually wouldn't be really interesting to watch.
No.
So
– well, we'll get to the – yeah, I want to get to The Shining in a second. But we're talking about – so we're talking about the race.
Okay. Sorry.
When the race – no, I'm looking for it. When the race is going on, I'm like, oh, this is – this is the Copper Key, not the Tomb of Horrors and Joust. And then watching the race unfold, I was like, okay, this looks great on the screen.
Yes.
This looks fantastic. This is one of the best parts of the movie. And comparing this to him standing at a Joust console, yeah, I see. I'll grudgingly admit this was cooler than him playing Joust. I was really wanting to see Tomb of Horrors and Joust, but I will in retrospect, I will admit that an awesome race involving Bigfoot and the DeLorean and a dinosaur from Jurassic
King Kong, man.
No, it was a dinosaur first. The Tyrannosaurus.
Oh, yeah.
Tyrannosaurus was eating cars, yeah. And then King Kong, yeah. Yeah, and I liked all the IOI cars getting smashed and everything, and Artemis on her motorcycle. That was really cool. I liked that a lot. By the way, what did you think about how H was? Let's talk about the character for a minute, then we'll go to go to The Shining. Before we get into The Shining, let's talk about the character. So what did you think about how the characters were different? Because I think Wade was pretty much the same. I think I'm not going to give my opinions yet. I just want to kind of list the differences, and then let's see what you think about them and what I think about them. Here were kind of the differences. Wade was more or less the same. Artemis looked completely different and had a different role in the world. We'll get to that. And then H was the same idea, just looked more interesting, I think, visually than what we were expecting from the book. And was funny. And then Shoto uses up too many syllables, so Sho, they were very different. Now, let's work our way down the high five. Wade, how would you say he was different in the movie, and is that good or bad?
I think you're right. I think he was pretty much the same.
Yeah. Yeah, not a lot. I think that more than any other character in the entire thing, other than maybe Sorrento, they tried to keep him... Oh, by the way, even I-Rock is completely different in the movie. So let's throw him on there, too. We'll get to him. All right. So, Artemis... this is the one that people were saying if there was one change they made that was probably going to make people happy. Now, I've never understood exactly what people don't like about her in the book. I think she's great in the book. She's at least as smart as Wade. She's usually ahead of Wade. She found the Tomb of Horrors before he did. She just wasn't good at Joust, randomly. She's ahead of him later in the game as well. In the book, I think she's fine. But in the movie, they gave her even more agency, I guess. So what do you think about that?
I was fine with it. I mean, you're right. In the movie, she had a bigger role in real life. In the books, her role in real life was much more limited.
Yes.
I don't want to see you in real life, Wade. That was her role in real life.
Yeah.
In the movie, she had much more to do in real life. And I get it. I mean, that was fine. They kind of reversed her and Wade's roles in terms of being the infiltrating agent.
Yeah.
You
know what, John? I just thought about this. This just occurred to me. I think that this is very important. One of the reasons that Artemis doesn't get as much ink and have as big of a role to play in the book as in the movie that people just don't seem to notice is that the book is written in first person from Wade's point of view. And let me tell you, I've written two or three books from first person point of view. It is literally limiting because you can't describe what any other character is doing except the main character unless they're standing in front of the main character. Mm-hmm. But the reader only sees what the main character sees. So, you know, in that book, it was literally impossible to have a chapter where, like, you're like, meanwhile, with Artemis, she's doing this. No, you can't do that. You know, the only thing you could do would be to have Wade say, Artemis later told me that she was doing this, you know. But mm-hmm. but that's kind
of
awkward.
Or I called Artemis and she was in the middle of doing this or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're doing a first-person point of view story, it is going to be 90 to 95% the main character. That's just how it works. You know, so if you wanted more Artemis in the book, that's fine. It just needed to be a third-person, like Game of Thrones type of book.
Yes.
Okay.
I was fine with the first person in the book because of the virtual reality side of it. It made sense, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So, did you like the idea there was like a rebellion and she was involved in this anti-IOI business or whatever it was? I didn't really fully understand.
I think the idea was that there was organized people who were working against IOI to win the contest, which... I mean, but what's the difference between that and like clans?
The clans, yeah, I didn't understand.
I that seemed kind of six of one, half dozen the other to me.
Right. I agree.
But it's fine. I mean, I get it. Like, and the idea that they helped out Wade in real life was fine because we're gonna talk about this in a minute. One of the other differences was the much reduced role of Ogden in the movie.
Yeah.
Where in the real life world, he didn't help them. And in the book,
until the very
he does
end.
Help them. And so she takes and her group kind of took over some of that role.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Okay, so let's continue on the characters and we'll keep going like that. I thought H was just a lot more fun in the movie. I mean, H is fine in both. And they don't change her a lot. But doing interesting visual things like making H a cyborg, you know, a big gray cyborg and having a garage building stuff and having, you know, the Iron Giant and all that. I liked all that stuff that they added onto H.
I did. I mean, I thought it also, I mean, I did like all that stuff. It was good. It made H an interesting character. And we haven't even talked, we're going to talk about the movie part of H's reaction. That was
really
good. Oh,
that was great. Yeah.
But I mean, one of the I thought it reduced a little bit H's knowledge of the culture stuff was on par with, you know, with the others, and I think it kind of reduced that by giving H these other jobs. Basically, I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, but I do. Yeah, I agree with you. That you just see more personality because in the book, H is just like Wade's. You know, slightly cooler, slightly older brother, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of looks after him. And here mm-hmm. he was more like the utility guy, like the person that has the right weapon or knows how to build something real fast or something, which was kind of neat, I thought. It's just different. What about Daito and Shoto? Because they were pretty substantially different in the movie.
Yeah, no, in the book, they were not people who ever left their apartments.
Right.
Ever. So.
Well, except at the end for Daito.
Yeah,
hurry.
But I mean, but in their day to day.
That's a grim.
And they were obviously,
that's a grim joke.
You know, and the idea that one of them was a 11-year-old or whatever, it was fine. I was fine with them changing that. As soon as I saw the guy was an 11-year-old, I was like, well, they're not killing one of them off.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, I loved them. I like I said, I just listened to the audiobook again, and what I realized from the audiobook is how little they're actually in it. So they're such,
yeah, no, they're barely in the book at all.
They're such colorful characters in both that they seem like they're in more than they are. And what I liked about them in the what I thought was interesting about them, I don't necessarily liked it. What was interesting about them in the book was that even when they sort of made common cause with Wade and you thought of him as the high five, they still kind of rebuffed him. They didn't want to work with him, except they – it says that – remember when – the way it played out in the book was when Artemis told Wade, I don't want to, you know, be around you for a while. We need to focus on our, you know, our business here and don't be calling me. And Wade kind of goes off in a huff. What he does is he go teams up with Daito and Shoto, but we just kind of get a summary of this. We don't actually see it. They go
That's
off
right.
and do a bunch of dungeons and stuff and gather weapons. So this is when Wade gets stuff like, you know, what will eventually be the thing that turns into Ultraman. And even then, after they do that battle, Daito was very off-puttish. He didn't want to be close with Wade. In fact, the only thing that Wade does that kind of remotely gets through to Daito is when they get the Ultraman capsule.
The beta capsule.
Shoto is like, we should let Wade have it because, you know, it was his idea to go do this. And Daito is like, no, we're Japanese, you know, we got it, we're going to keep it. And Wade is like, no, you're right, you should keep it. And Daito is like, oh, you are a man of honor, Wade, you know, Wade-san, you know, Parzival-san. So that was like the one time Daito had anything good to say. They were very off-puttish. They were very, just the two of them. Now, in the movie, I really liked them. I thought they were funny. I thought they were, their two avatars are awesome. The big red samurai and the yellow ninja. Shoto gets probably my favorite line in the entire movie. Do you remember this? Or show? I know people that haven't read the book and are just seen the movie are like, who is Shoto? In the movie, they call him Sho. I guess so he doesn't sound like Daito. But do you remember his line?
Which one?
Ninjas don't hug. That was great. He's like an 11-year-old ninja, and he's just like, everybody's hugging. He's like, ninjas don't hug. I just thought he was great. I thought Shoto was my favorite surprise character. It was kind of like when I saw the Fellowship of the Ring the first time, and I'd never cared anything about Merry and Pippin, and I still hated Pippin. But I thought Merry was really interesting, that he'd never, in the book, Merry is dull as dishwater, but in the movie, Merry is awesome. And it's the same way with Shoto. In the movie, I'm like, he's really funny. He's cute. He's this little 11-year-old kid. You know, I got a 9-year-old daughter, so it kind of tracked for me. So I'm looking forward to what Mira thinks about Shoto when we go see it tomorrow. So yeah, I thought they were actually improved in the movie. And they both live, which is nice.
Yes.
And they're fun. You know, they're happy and grinny and laughy and fun. Instead of in the book, they're just so dreadfully dour and grim. It's just like, all right. You want to talk about the second, the Jade Key?
Sure. The big challenge for that in the books, they introduce a technology where you can go into a movie and basically experience the movie in real time, like it's a real world. But in the movie, I mean, in the book, they use it in several ways. One way you have to actually act out the movie as a character. Another way is you're just in it. Mm-hmm. But in the movie, they figure out that the clue they have to go into is the date movie that he went on with this woman, and it's The Shining.
Yeah,
and they go into The Shining.
They really do. It's a freaking amazing.
They literally are in The Shining.
Yeah.
And
H doesn't like horror movies, and he's never seen The Shining.
Yes, which is funny. Really funny.
If this scene had been in the book, H would have seen The Shining 40 times and studied the script. You know what I mean? But in the movie, it was funnier to go with the idea that he knew nothing. So H gave you some good comedy in it, too, yeah.
And then he asked one of the other guys, did you see The Shining? I guess it was Shoto. And he says, through my fingers, you know, and that's kind of how I feel about The Shining, too. Like, I don't watch horror movies, and I've saw The Shining a long time ago, and I, you know, did not enjoy it. So as soon as I realized they were going to that movie, I was like, oh, crap. So you knew bad things were going to happen.
I've seen it several times, and I've read the book. I'm a big fan of The Shining. It's one of my favorite Stephen King stories, and I feel about it kind of the way what's his name? The creator of The Oasis, Halliday. I feel about it kind of the way Halliday did, which is saying, you know, that Stephen King didn't like it. Well, I didn't like the movie that much either because they totally changed it for the Stanley Kubrick just totally changed it. But it is iconic. There's no doubt about that.
Yes.
And so, seeing the two little girls and the blood and the old lady in the tub and everything, you know, that's – you never really saw Jack Nicholson, but you definitely saw the fire axe coming through everything. That was the other thing I was going to ask you about. So instead of like researching in their files, which would have been boring, they go to like the Smithsonian of Halliday. What did you think about all that? That they'd go in there together and like be in the research library of videos? Because that was very
different. For a movie, I thought it worked better.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the idea that they go back in their individual caves or, you know, his van or wherever else he was, apartment later, and that they're like, you know, watching old 80s movies again or TV shows for clues or reading stuff about articles about how are they for clues is, again, not visually stimulating for a movie. It's very dry. That would be very dry, kind of boring stuff, even if they're like chatting as they're watching a movie or whatever. So the idea of this, like you're saying, museum library kind of thing with the holograms of the, all his major life events made sense from a movie perspective. And I was fine with that.
Yeah. The only thing for me is that it just seemed like it made it all very obvious. I guess you have to remind yourself that it's not like there were only a handful of clips there. They were specifically, this is something that the average moviegoer might not understand, is the quests, the puzzles, the riddles, the things to get the keys, they probably came across easier than they should have, I think, in the movie. It seemed like it was easier. It was like that, you know, everybody knew where the race was, everybody was trying it every day, and Wade figured one little thing out and finished it. And then they solved 2 and 3 almost immediately with no delay. In the book, you know, a lot of time passes between each of the puzzles getting solved because, you know, when they get one key or one gate, they get the clue for the next one and nobody can figure it out for a long time. I mean, there's a couple that are pretty quick, but for the most part, it takes some time. You know, there's like weeks and months go by between, if I remember correctly.
And nothing happens.
Yeah, nothing. And the scoreboard stays the same. Other than the Sixers come in and like put a force field around it or something to cheat because they're a bunch of cheaters. But what I'm saying is people that watched the movie and hadn't read the book could be certainly forgiven for thinking that it was easier than it actually was. And I'm saying what I think we have to remind ourselves is that Halliday library, video library, housed probably thousands and thousands and millions of clips like that. And they were having to use their pre-existing knowledge of him to pick out the right ones to then watch to get the clues that they then figured out. So it's not like you just walked in there and Halliday says, you should try going backwards, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
You had to know which one of those clips out of probably millions to watch and then watch it all the way to the end and know what he means when he says that, you know.
And exactly. You're exactly right. And also, like, the idea of a written clue that's a, you know, that requires, you know, breaking it down and thought and there's, you know, references in it. Works much better in a book where you can see the clue and they can debate the references and what it means and stuff. In the movie, like, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't go anywhere. So I'm fine with how they did that.
We got two sections left to look at. The whole thing in the real world, which was different, but I think was good. And then the final, you know, the crystal key, the big finish. Now, I forgot exactly how I was going to ask this, but how does it? Well, not exactly how to put it, but well, let's go ahead and look at the last one then. The real world part. IOI in the book is just kind of a big faceless corporation. Whereas in the movie, you spend a whole lot of time around like Sorrento's chair. It's like they focused on visual things that you could, you know, build a set of and interact in. So instead of just kind of going all over here and there, like Artemis spends a lot of time sneaking around in that room where his chair is, where his haptic suit is, you know, and inside those little cages and everything. What it, you know, in the book, one of my, I think my probably my favorite sequence in the entire book is when Wade intentionally gets himself taken into servitude just so he can be inside IOI and hack it from the inside.
No, I thought that was brilliant because it really was, because in the movie, she was taken in the real world just because they were hunting for Wade and they found and they found her.
Right.
In the book, they put the shield up around the third gate, mm-hmm. and no one could get there. And the only way to take the shield in was to go inside IOI. So that's what Wade did in the real world.
Yeah.
And so that requires a level of dedication and planning and thought and execution.
Absolutely.
That I thought the characters in the real world didn't have in this movie.
Right. Yeah, Wade realizes that if they can't get that force field down, it's over. The Sixers are just eventually going to figure it out because they get to the last gate first. And by the way, that does show you the benefit of having keys and gates, is that, you know, you can get to the key and still have to go through the gate. The Sixers had the crystal key. All they had to do was get the gate open and they win. But they couldn't get the gate open. So they had the big force field up while they were messing with it. And that's how Wade gets to the last gate, is to get rid of the force field by going inside. So yeah, Artemis goes in instead. But instead of, and I thought it was neat too that I'm trying to think, how in the movie, in the book, Wade has already bought some black market codes that he has no idea if they're going to work or not. So that's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And Klein doesn't tell you up front what's going on. It's like in one chapter, you know, Wade's doing his thing on the Oasis, and the next chapter, people are knocking his door down, and you're like, oh my gosh.
You think he's really in trouble.
Yeah, you don't know this is on purpose at first.
Yes, and that was really good how he did that, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So she actually does get captured, but then she turns that to their advantage by being able to, I don't even remember now, she does some stuff.
No, Wade finds her in their system.
Yeah.
So I can't remember now. And then they hack her out of the...
Oh, she has the password to his chair.
That's right. So she has the password to his chair. Now, Wade has a password to his chair because he saw him in the chat or whatever. And they use that to hack him. And then they get her out of... And then they use the chair and they get her out. And then they then she goes in his chair and turns the shield off.
Right. Oh, and by the way, that brings up that other character we needed to mention, IROC. In the book, IROC is just an annoying dude that likes to come over sometime and hang out in H's basement, which is the equivalent of his garage in the movie. But and the only thing IROC accomplishes in the book is that IROC is allegedly the one that brags about the copper key online, and that's how Daito and Shoto figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would have only been the first three, but then IROC hears about it and goes and puts it on a message board, and Daito and Shoto figure it out. In the movie, IROC is like a mercenary soldier idiot that works for Sorrento.
But he is, his character is, I think, is really well done in the movie, because he's like if there was like a 14-year-old boy who was like a really powerful video game
trying to be
character,
yeah,
who was working for the bad guys.
Yeah,
like that's how he acts in the movie, and I think it's pretty well done.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the guy that plays Ehrlich, or played Ehrlich on Silicon Valley, which is kind of funny too, because he's that's kind of how that character is. He's not on there anymore. So yeah, I thought he was, you know what that character's like. He's kind of like, again, the comparison with turning Lord of the Rings into a movie, you kind of had to do similar things. Remember how in Fellowship of the Ring, they just totally invented the lead orc just for
the Uruk-hai guy.
Yeah. For somebody for Aragorn to fight, to shoot Boromir and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Same thing. You need like the lieutenant, you need the thug second banana that you can kind of make fun of, and you can have the main characters beat him up easier than they beat up the main villain.
Yeah, no, I thought and he can be the other bad guy that's more in the Oasis while Sorrento's more out of the Oasis.
Yeah, that's right. And hey, we did get Mechagodzilla. I couldn't believe it. I really didn't think we would.
I thought that was great.
Yeah. Yeah, we did get some robots and stuff. It turned into just kind of a melee, but I was hoping we still might see some Shogun Warriors. That was the other question I was going to ask you before. Were there any, I mean, we know, yeah, Tomb of Horrors and Joust and all that, obviously. And I've also got to say, before I forget, what I'm going to ask you is, were there other properties that were missing from the movie that you really wished had been in there? But before I ask you that, let me tell you this. I thought that probably one of the most disappointing things to me about the movie, just in how it was made, was the music. Because I did like some of the music they used. I felt like it was kind of trying to do the same thing that Guardians of the Galaxy did, which is pick songs that are both from that era that they're talking about, and the message in the song kind of is appropriate for those parts of the movie, you know. Mm-hmm. But the problem was in Guardians of the Galaxy, and I took it for granted. But looking back now, my respect for James Gunn is even greater. Because James Gunn was able to find songs for Guardians of the Galaxy that, A, were from the right era, B, were appropriate to the scenes in which they were used, and C, sounded really good during the movie.
Yes.
And I felt like in this movie, Spielberg, he did find songs that were appropriate to the time, and he did have songs where the message went along with it, but to me, several of the songs just didn't do much for me. They weren't peppy, or they didn't fit the scene music-wise. You know what I mean?
I agree 100%. Which is sad, because there was so much to work with there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it was. I think the reason it was so obvious, at least to me, it might have been anyway, was that I've watched all the trailers a bunch. And in the trailers, you get Tom Sawyer by Rush, which isn't 2112, but it's even a more iconic song from that era. And you get Take On Me, which works so great when they're at the Distracted Globe dance thing. And in the movie, you got Staying Alive, which just doesn't have the same power as that Take On Me with the big orchestral power behind it that they had in the trailer, you know. Yeah. It just, the music to me was a little flat. I bought the music from, there's two albums. It's just like they do all these now. There's the album with the score, like the orchestral score. It's Alvin Silvestri. And then there's the basically playlist they put together and are selling based on songs they use. And it's got like, We're Not Gonna Take It, and I Want to Be Your Lover by Prince, and
Jump by Van Halen.
Yeah, and Staying Alive and all that. Actually, you know, I don't think Jump is on it. It was certainly
the movie opens with Jump.
I know, but I don't think it's on the album I just bought. I got to go back and look. But yeah, so it didn't have that. I was really disappointed it didn't have several of the songs. But anyway, what property or properties were most egregious to you that were not in it? Because I'm not sure.
I mean, there was more Star Wars stuff in the book. I mean, they have actual lightsabers, they talk about them in the movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. They reference the Millennium Falcon and stuff. Yeah. But in the book, like, they have actual, he has with the kind of fighter that Luke has.
X-Wing.
He has an X-Wing. The other people have the Millennium Falcon. They have the Firefly ship in the movie, and he has that.
I was going to say, I don't want to just dote over the properties and the references, but I do have to say I got excited when I saw the Serenity. The Firefly.
And some of the, I mean, again, we talked about the Dungeons and Dragons stuff. There's some kind of fantasy stuff more in the book that aren't in the movie from a property perspective. I mean, I want to reference some stuff that was in the movie, that properties that were in the movie that weren't in the book that I thought were pretty, that I loved when I saw them. the magic spell that they said that raised the shield. You know what that?
Yes.
You know what that's from, right?
That's from Excalibur.
100%. That's Merlin's spell from Excalibur that brought the fog and stuff.
Yep.
And so as soon as he started saying it, I just started laughing in the theater.
Yeah, me too.
And so that kind of thing. I mean, I really appreciated that. And then at one point, Shoto throws like a ninja star boomerang thing.
Oh, it's the glaive.
I thought it was the Beastmaster glaive thing, wasn't it?
I think it was from Krull. I think it was the glaive from Krull. Yeah. I mean, they may have used one like that in Beastmaster too. It probably did. I haven't seen it. I remember he did have something like that though in the commercials. But yeah, but I know for sure that was the glaive from Krull. That was awesome. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. Again, it's not about those things, but you're right. It does give you flavor. It ties it back to that world. And it's, like I said, it's like sprinkles on top of the cake. It's not about the sprinkles, but hey, the sprinkles are fun, right?
And the sprinkles are fun. And I like a world in which all the sprinkles are in the same place. I mean, I like the fact that there was a battle with Mechagodzilla and a Gundam warrior and the ship from Firefly and Iron Giant, and there was guys from Halo, and there was Battletoads, and was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and, you know, there was, I mean, in one of the earlier scenes, it was a guy from StarCraft, and so, like, I like all that. I mean, I was happy that all that was, you know, and then there was, you know, wizards and you know, other video game characters and stuff. So, I mean, I enjoyed that part of it. I think that's really cool.
That's the other character I need to ask you about before we get into the finale. And that's, and we talked about it a little bit already, and that's Halliday himself. I think that Halliday was much more in the movie than he was in the book, right?
Yes.
And how did that come across to you? How'd that play?
It was fun because you were trying to solve his puzzle. So it's interesting. I think you're right in the sense that it made it more about him.
Yeah.
Right.
And understanding him. Yeah.
In the book, it's less about him and more about the pop culture stuff that he liked. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And less about his personal life.
Yes, absolutely. Right. It wasn't just figuring out, oh, he likes war games, I should memorize every dialogue from war games. Instead, it was he broke up with his girlfriend. I need to understand what happened so I can go forward. Yeah, that's, and I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was different. It was fine. I mean, but it wasn't the same in that sense.
No, it was not. It was not. No.
But he was fine as a character, and I bought him as the, you know, kind of Asperger-y kind of computer programmer guy.
Well, I loved how we got the scene of Sorrento working for him. And, you know, Wade is like, you know, oh, Sorrento has always said that he, like, was his apprentice or something. And instead he was the guy that brought him coffee. And I like how, I mean, this is just an example of several ways that they really were able to sum big ideas up in just a short little exchange in the movie, is where Sorrento is like, no, you know, you should have, like, gold level and platinum level and charge more for platinum level and blah, blah, blah. And Halliday's like, this is good coffee, you know. That I mean, in just that one exchange, you totally understood that Sorrento was about making money, about charging people more. You know, he's basically non-net neutrality, basically. You know what I'm saying? And Halliday wants everybody to be able to get in for like a quarter, you know, or whatever, like playing a video
game. Free. I mean, he views it as a resource.
Right. Right. So I did like what they did with Halliday, and I thought that Rylance did a good job with that. I was glad that he was in it as much as he was. Because when I heard, you know, Mark Rylance is playing Halliday, I'm like, okay, well, Mark Rylance is going to be in about 2 minutes of this movie. Well, no. He was in quite a bit of it, you know, between the video clips that they were watching and then, you know, other stuff. So, okay, so the big finale, like we were saying, they had the shield over the Castle Anorak. I was excited that they still used the whole sequence where they blow everybody up, although they turned it into a movie blowing everybody up. I think in the book, they just sort of do it off stage because, you know, because Wade's getting too close or whatever.
Yes.
Whereas in the movie, you have to have the whole, you know, he hits part one of it, he hits part two of it, he hits part three and all that. But I like that they kept that and the quarter. What do you think about the quarter?
No, I think it was important. I mean, I think the idea of the extra life in the quarter was a big part of that. And I'm glad they kept it.
Yeah.
I get why they didn't do the Pac-Man scene to get it. That's fine. But the idea of – I think the difference is in the book, Halliday set up a challenge where the quarter could be earned. And in the movie, Ogden just gave him the quarter.
Ogden
changed the rules.
Which you know what? I think that kind of moves the last scene up. Because in the book, Ogden sort of cheats to help the High Five. And he tells him, I wasn't going to, you know, get involved, but Sorrento's cheating. And I don't think James would mind if I leveled the playing field.
Yes.
Whereas in the movie, it's kind of the same attitude. He just does it at a different time in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that worked out that all right. I want to say one other thing about the about playing, about how that comes across in the book, him playing the video games versus the movie. Again, I have a different perspective because I've listened to Will Wheaton read the audiobook, perform the audiobook. And I got to tell you, if you're just reading the book, the words on the page, you have Wade saying, I played a perfect game of Pac-Man. That's how I did it. I did all this, and I went over here, and I ate the little berries, and I did this, and I played a perfect game of Pac-Man, and I won this thing, and I got a quarter. And you're just like, okay, that was, you know, that would look terrible in the movie. But what Will Wheaton does is like, I had to play the perfect game of Pac-Man. And he puts such performance into it that he makes those scenes that you think are, you know, probably the most boring parts of the book, he makes them interesting and exciting. So, you know, that goes a long way. So anything else about the final battle? We had the whole the Iron Giant suit up, you know, where H is basically driving the Iron Giant, isn't she? I mean, she's like,
oh yeah,
that's her character, that's her thing. And doesn't Daito turn into something and he's fighting the, or Shoto?
He turns into a Gundam warrior and fights Mechagodzilla and kills Mechagodzilla.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was. I don't know what a Gundam is. So this is the thing for me. A lot of the stuff in the book is gaming, but a lot of it is not. And it felt like to me in the movie, when you get to the big melees, it's almost all gaming stuff. There was Chucky, but it was just so much. It was Halo and robots and I have Akira or whatever and the motorcycle and all that, and I'm just like, I have no idea what any of this is. But see, that just further proves my point, because I didn't know what any of that was and I didn't care. I just knew it was cool stuff that the good guys and the bad guys were using.
Yes.
So I couldn't have cared less what it was from. It could have just been.
No, and I'm sure there are 100 references that I didn't get in the movie that I missed or whatever. So.
So what? Anything else about the big finish? And then of course they go back. They actually are driving. I like that they were driving the truck. H was driving the truck around Columbus, and so it made them in the game bounce all around. Like Wade couldn't even get the key in the hole because he kept scraping, trying to, you know, he's getting thrown around. And then you get that great. I love the bit at the end where, in the book, Halliday just shows him the big red button that ends the Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, as soon as he shows it to Wade, Wade falls forward, which makes Parzival fall forward, and he almost hits it. And Halliday is like, try not to destroy the entire Oasis on your first day on the job.
All right, I have a question for you about that scene.
Yeah.
So he said Halliday wasn't a scripted program or whatever.
Right. I was trying to.
So what is Halliday in that scene? Is he supposed to be like his consciousness is in the game, or he's artificial intelligence now?
Or is he on a desert island just playing it and gotten away from everything?
No, I think he's dead.
Okay.
He's definitely dead. So he's either an artificial intelligence is portraying him.
Right.
Or his consciousness is uploaded in the game, and he just gave Wade a big red button to erase him.
So, like, which he instantly almost did.
Yeah, so that part was a little, you know, I was like, okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm going to see it again tomorrow, and I'll pay special attention and try to figure out what's going on there. But so do you have any intention to see it again anytime soon?
I mean, and there are very few movies that I go see in the theater twice.
Me too.
Very, right. Very, very few. But I haven't seen Black Panther again in the theater, and I love Black Panther. So I'm skeptical.
Okay.
But I'll be definitely going to, you know, look forward to seeing a video with the rest of the family when it comes out. So
I'm trying to figure out, this is probably my, this is probably my favorite movie of the year. I really like Black Panther. I didn't love it as much as everybody seems to, but I certainly, for me, Black Panther was like at least an 8 out of 10, maybe 8.5. I think it's easily the best of the solo Marvel movies. It's better than any of the Iron Mans or maybe Civil War, but that's not really a solo movie by the time you get to the third Captain America. But anyway, I think this one, I think Ready Player One is up there. You know, the other movie that I saw this year so far in the theater that is right up in my top 2 or 3 right now?
What?
Peter Rabbit.
Good golly.
It was so good. I was dragged kicking and screaming to see it because, you know, Maddie and Mira wanted to see it and Amy wanted to see it. And I'm sitting there just like counting the seconds until I can get out of that theater. And I start watching it and it is awesome. It is so cute. It's so funny. I thought it was great. So, which is an appropriate thing for me to say on Easter, a movie about a rabbit. So there you go, because today's Easter and April Fool's Day. So maybe I just made all that up. Anything else that we haven't hit on about the movie or the book or the movie and the book?
No, I think we've covered the main things. I mean, I think at the end part, you were talking about the van and how you liked that. I mean, I liked the part that Ogden intervened and saved them in the real world. And made them safe so then they could compete in the game without the threat to their well-being.
Right.
But that's not as dramatic as people trying to kill them. And then you don't get the scene at the end with like the crowd of people trying to protect Wade or whatever. So
that's the thing. You're exactly right. That's the main – I think that's one of the 2 or 3 main overall structural differences between the movie and the book is in the book, things happen – dramatic moments happen, and then you kind of have like a calm period after that, where people are on the computer for days or weeks, or they're in the Oasis or whatever, and then you'll have another dramatic moment, and then you have a long calm period where Wade's researching this or having conversations with that or whatever. Yeah, in the movie, it's just bang, 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 bang. It's like everything happens in about 2 days. It seems like.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems a lot faster.
I mean, the other thing is like, I really like the scene when the bad woman who worked for Sorrento was driving, chasing them, or whatever. She saw all the people wearing the Oasis gear, like fighting in the battle or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was really good because it just showed like how everybody else cared or was involved or whatever. I don't know.
That's Yeah, I did notice that too. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it shows that. Here they are thinking that they basically rule the world, and you can see all the people out on the streets fighting against them, basically. Because they got everybody to come and participate against IOI. Well, which do you like? You like the book better still?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to be honest. That's who I am.
Yeah.
So, no worries.
I think I like the book better, too. I'm going to have to see the movie a couple more times for it to really take root so I can evaluate it properly. This is very much still my initial impression. But, yeah, I'll say this. I like the book better overall. But I think that there are parts of the movie that are at least as good, and some parts are even better. And like we've been saying, in terms of for a movie... much better, even though we're disappointed that the
Oh, 100%. Again, like you said, the race scene was awesome.
Yeah.
It was, and I love the elements of it. I love, you know, the Tyrannosaurus Rex and King Kong and the jumps and the stuff in it. I mean, that was, you know,
I wish
that would be very cool.
Like I said, I wish I hadn't seen the whole thing basically in the trailer. But yeah, in the trailer, I didn't understand the significance of it. I kept thinking, when are they having a car chase? When is this? You know, I mean, I couldn't for the life of me figure out what story plot point required a car chase. Mm-hmm. And so then when they say, this is the first challenge, I'm just like, wow, okay. They just threw everything out and we're going to have a car race for the first key. That was kind of mind blowing. So that's when I was sitting there going, this is going to be a very different story. And again, that's not that bad. It's kind of like what you and I have said. You know, I think I've made this point several times. We talk about Game of Thrones, that I'm not disappointed that if they ever do, you know, if he ever finishes their last couple of books, they'll be different. Because we just get a whole separate story. And it was the same thing here. This doesn't ruin the book for me. It kind of gives me an alternate story of the same story. And that's cool.
That's very fair.
We still got the book. I just listened to it a couple of days ago. Last thing. He's confirmed now he's writing a sequel. Is it Ready Player Two? And what do you think the thrust of it will be?
I mean, I guess.
Will they hit the red button?
It'll be some threat to the Oasis, you know.
There's no way it could be as good as the first one, is there?
I don't know where they can go with it that'll be, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you read Armada, so we already know that.
Yeah, no, I mean, he wrote that, and that was not nearly as good.
No.
So
it was okay, but it wasn't It wasn't as bad as some people say, but I mean, when you're comparing it to freaking Ready Player One, which is a classic. In fact, I've about decided Ready Player One is my second favorite book of all time now. I didn't want to believe that, but I just kept thinking how much I like it and how much I keep wanting to listen to it. And I kept thinking, doesn't this mean I like it a whole lot if I keep wanting to listen to it over and over and read it over and over and I'm dying for the movie to come out? I mean, that kind of means I like it a whole lot, I think.
No, I mean, I love the book. It hits a lot of sweet spots for me. I mean, I read the book and I felt like this book was written for me sometimes. Some ways. So it's not for everybody.
No, it's definitely not.
I'm fine with that. So.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave you all with this one more time. I'm not kidding. Whatever it costs, get the audiobook. You will not regret it. Even if you just read the paperback or whatever. Get Will Wheaton's audio performance. I promise you, it is a totally different experience to listen to him read it. All right, any final thoughts? Ready Player One.
I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Yep.
Always glad to talk about this with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've done at least a couple of shows on this. And I'm doing another show, by the way, tomorrow night on this. So it'll be interesting to hear other perspectives. I'm going to be, you remember, we used to be part of the Earth Station One network. And I'm still very good buddies with those fine folks. And so they knew how much I liked the book. And so they invited me to come on and do this week's Earth Station One, Ready Player One, the movie review. So tune in to Earth Station 1 the first week or so of April, and you can hear some other people talking with me about this. So, as always, we have to thank our fine sponsors via Patreon.com. You too can be part of the family and help keep our shows on the air by going to Patreon.com, Patreon.com/Van Allen Plexico, or just go to Patreon.com and search Plexico, and it'll come right up. And you can join the crowd. We do lots of fun stuff all year long for our patrons in exchange for their fine support. Our patrons include Nicholas Cottrell, Joseph Fine, Christopher Burleson, Samuel Salvatore, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Justin Bean, Chris Usher, and then David Evers, Tom Anderson, Timothy, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Steve Harlan, Andrew Barber, Jared Albrick, Rich Reimer, Bill Matthews, Will Summerford, John McCune, Catherine England, Ann Kangian, and then David Simpson, Josh Teal, Mike Finley, Randall Walker, C.T. Wayne, Earl Ricks, Dave Powell, Michael Kirshner, Mick Vigicana, Matt
Robin Heimer, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, George Gaston, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, and then Clay Henson, J.W. Rice, Wardam Wade, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Russell Milling, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Brant Rumble, and Nicholas Craig, plus our one-time and anonymous donors. If I left anyone off, let me know. And you can see links to all of this very simply by going to my website, www.plexico.net. We have links to the White Rocket page, to all of our podcasts, to Patreon, and to everything else that we do at White Rocket Entertainment. Thanks a bunch. All right, John. Well, I appreciate, as always, you coming on. It's always fun. And take it easy, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, man. Good to talk about it.
All right. The Rocket's going to get out of here for another week. We'll see you guys down the road.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.